session number 20486, Reel 6.
John Young, Reel 6.
Well, come middle of July, the Germans were quite active on the northern front in Italy, and my Bow fighters were working not only in Yugoslavia, but in support of the troops on the front line at night, who were being dive-bombed by Ju-87s. And on one occasion, I remember one of my young men, who I recommended and who received the DFC, came back with a Bow fighter which had had its wings bent up as he twizzled around in the moonlight to get a Ju-87. Anyway, come to the middle of July, I was due to finish my operation sequence, and I took off, I think, on the evening of the 14th of July. And my radar was unserviceable, so I returned and took off again later in the night with an unbent radar and did an operation at the end of the night. I think I did an interception, but not anything to report successful. And 11 o'clock the next morning, on July the 15th, my adjutant urgently shook me on the head and said, "Sir, you've got to wake up." So I said, "Oh, no, I've finished my operation to it." And he said, no. He said, "The CNC wants to see you on the tarmac at Lucca. That's in Malta, of course. It's 200 and goodness knows how many miles away. At 2:30 this afternoon. And you are to give over command of the squadron to your senior flight commander and be there." So I had a squadron to hand over, and Doc Ritchie, my operator, decided he'd already done two tours, not to do another one, so I picked up another very good operator, and we flew down to Malta. Of course, I hadn't shaved or anything, and there was this highly operational looking Bow fighter, of course, had done two operations the previous night. And I arrived on the tarmac, and there was Hugh and there was Keith Park on the tarmac, you see. So I got out and greeted him, and he looked at me, and I said, "Good afternoon." So he said, "Good afternoon, John." He said, "I've got a little job I want you to do." So I said to him, "Sir, well, of course, I finished my third tour last night, sir." And he said, "Yes, I know about that," he said, "but I've got this little job." He said, "I'm in a hurry now. What I want you to do is to go and have dinner with Air Marshal Foster tonight, and he'll tell you all about it." And he said, and take over 108. And he said, "I'm appointing you CO of the Mediterranean Night Striking Force." Right? So I was completely in the dark about this, you see. Anyway, I went over to 108 Squadron, and there was Banham, who'd taken over, you see, when I'd come out to North Africa, ready to hand over to me. And I found myself with the most beautiful bedroom at Lucca you've ever seen, with a wonderful view of Valletta Harbour. And then we went on a sort of takeover tour about 4:30 that afternoon. And we went down to a concert by the airmen at Marshal Sherlock and the hangar at Marshal Sherlock, where they were running an afternoon concert because they couldn't do ones in the evening as a night flight squadron. And we walked, Banham and I walked down the central aisle of this concert hall, and slowly, as we got down towards the stage, the two comedians on the thing, the music changed from whatever it was to "I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles," which was, of course, the airman's nickname for me. Now, how did the airman know I was taking over when I'd only just been given command by the CNC 2 hours before. I've never worked that one out. Anyway, I Banham left, and I started taking over. And of course, we had Mozzie 12, both fighters and Mozzie 12s. But incredibly, just after I took over, and I'd actually flown a Mozzie 12 at Lucca there, the rest of them were blown up at a place near Maison Blanche in North Africa by a landmine that had come bounced off a landing Ventura or Hudson or something. And so I was faced with the problem of what to do. I was told I couldn't have any more mosquitoes. What was I going to do? And so I don't think it's the entries in the logbook, but I went from Malta to El Adam, where there was an American Black Widow fighter in a hangar, all serviceable, and I flew it, and came to the conclusion that it was the most lovely aeroplane in the world, and completely beyond my training ability in the time available to form this night striking force. I was offered these things, you see, and I said it was completely beyond my, apart from the fact there weren't the air gunners to man the turrets. It had an excellent Mark 10 AI. So I went back to both fighters, both sixes, and stayed with both fighters. To get to Egypt, where Air Marshal Foster said I'd got to go, was a problem, because I'd been offered Dakotas to fly my men, leaving a defence flight at Malta to Egypt. But I've heard that there were two carriers in Malta that were going to Alex. And I thought, well, perhaps they could carry some of my men, you see. So I went down to the harbour and went on board the Antler. And there, as a commander flying, was an old Worcester, of course, who I'd been at school with, you see, Allingham. And he said, well, of course, you know, you can put 300 men on the flight deck camping between Malta and Alex. They'd love it. And we'll feed them, you see. And so I went on board the other Woolworth carrier, his name I can't remember. And there was, on this wing as commander flying, was Cahoon, who had been on the Combined Operations Staff course with me. And he likewise agreed to take 300 men camped on the flight deck of his carrier. So 600 of my men, the whole of the men who were going to go from Malta to Egypt, went by carrier from Malta to Alex. That took about 2 days, I think, each way for each of them. Had a most marvellous time. Getting their tot of rum every day, you see. So when I got to Egypt, I found, of course, life was a bit more serious. I flew the aeroplanes over. And our job was to go into Turkey. And my job was to get all the vehicles of this striking force, which of course consisted of 108 Squadron and some bow fighters of, I think it was 32 Squadron, and a couple of, or three airfield whatevers, a couple of radar, three radar stations, and take them to Turkey, where of course Buzi Kelit and my flight commander from the Battle of Britain time was the air attaché. And we took the whole damn lot up to Aleppo. And when we got to Aleppo, Keith Park came up to inspect us and then told me that in fact we weren't going to Turkey after all. The Turks had decided not to come in the war, and all my preparations to divide into three flights and go to Smyrna and Ankara and Istanbul and so on were to be put on hold, and we were to go back to Idku in Egypt. This was done. In the meantime, of course, we'd been keeping up the pressure on the Germans on Rhodes and in Crete by intruding at night. That was, of course, going on all continuously as well. And we went back to Idku. We were then told we were to go to Greece with part of the invasion force. And I went, I did my best to get over and see a Commodore Tuttle of Balkan Air Force, who was going to lead a lot of the Air Force into Greece, but I never managed to get over to him. Partly because while I was at Idku, one of my aircraft was shot down by the Egyptian Air Force. And the crew, not only the Egyptian pilot, but my crew were killed. He collided in a dummy attack. I say shot down, of course that wasn't quite right. He collided in a dummy attack and brought everything down. And I had to go to this funeral at El Adam. Or was it Mazamatru? One or the other. And then we started operating, preparatory to going into Greece, we started operating into the Aegean at night. This was quite high tech. The Navy sailed a very high speed cruiser equipped with a radar set through the eastern entrance to the Aegean at night, and I used to fly bow fighters into the western end through the Strait of Antikythera to meet him, and we would try and interfere with the German traffic between Crete and Rhodes and Egypt at night. I lost a couple of airplanes on that, and on one occasion, I remember very well, of course we were operating, remember, at 50 feet on dark nights with this radar comparison altimeter, which was incredibly reliable and usable. And I remember one night, I was given a target by this cruiser, and he was telling me to go to the left, and my operator was telling me to go to the left, and I swept to the left, and before I could say knife, there were the four engines about 10 feet below me, you see. This was a Dornier 24, which was operating as a sea skimmer across the Aegean at night. And it would be nice to say, of course, I swiggled around and shot him down, and you know damn well I didn't do anything of the sort. I lost him as he ducked into the shelter, the radar shelter of an island, you see. But another night, I did pick up somebody, and I was vectored onto them. And then my operator told me that he hadn't got a real blip, but he had got an overspill. So we followed this overspill until this fella came over one of the Greek islands where he started to operate, to orbit. And we started orbiting underneath him. And of course, on the overspill blip, you see, and I went up, got hold of this fellow, went up into the position up, down moon, down and up, you see, so that he was down there and I was up here, and I could see him silhouetted against the moonshine on the sea. And I did a quarter attack on him, and I'd had a hint from Keith Park that he didn't expect undue casualties from the for the Germans, if possible. The war was ending, and there were these 60,000 men, was it, immured in the Aegean, 30,000 on Crete, and 30,000 on Rhodes and Kos and Leros, and they were being fed, of course, by us on minimum rations, and my orders were to minimise the casualties, but make sure that they were kept in order. So I whopped this Heinko in the starboard engine, you see, and then, of course, unhappily, the lower gunner started being a bit offensive, and so I whopped him. Then this Heinkel went down into the sea. But of course, as I whopped the starboard engine, there was an enormous effusion of petrol from his starboard side, and it covered my aeroplane in flames. In the middle of the night, here was my aeroplane sitting in a great flame. Anyway, I went back to Gambut 3. Gambut 3, having shot him down. And when I got back to Gambut 3, I found that right through my tailplane there was an armour-piercing shell that had gone through the front leading edge of my tailplane, through its trailing edge, through the main hinge point of my port elevator, and out, so that I'd flown all the way back from the Aegean to North Africa with, shall I say, a waving in the breeze tailplane. However, I had been fairly modest in my victory spin over Gamma 3, and I didn't do anything silly. Anyway, long and short of it was, we went into Greece, and we hadn't been there long. We went, of course, first to that place on the west coast, then we went into Elenikon.
You mean Corfu?
No, I don't. I mean, I'll get it off the map in a moment for you. And then we went into Athens itself, and everything was pretty quiet for about a fortnight. But using my know-how from my Combined Operations Staff course, what I did was I put my aircraft detachment against the sea on the Elenikon airport, and I put my men in a place called Glyfada, which had a little harbour, so that if we had trouble, we had a means of retreat. Well, quite soon, of course, the Elas suddenly rebellion erupted, and I found my Glyfada redoubt under siege by night and by day, but not very seriously by day. And of course, fortunately, by then I got rid of my useless adjutant from Malta and got a very nice Australian who'd been an infantry officer in the First World War. And he initiated defensive patrols around my Glyfada redoubt, you see, which were exceedingly successful. He put on his Australian army hat from his First World War with the side up here, you see, put a 303 rifle under his arm, and went out walking with a small detachment of airmen who were volunteers. And we all slept quite well at night. But the Balkan Air Force ran into severe trouble because Tuttle, the Air Commodore, who was a good, an excellent pilot and had been head of PRU earlier in the war, was not a terribly good soldier. And what he'd done, he'd placed his headquarters up to Lev's, another of these L things, up in the hill of Kephissia, just above Athens, in a tower block overlooking Athens. Well, of course, that was absolutely lovely, except for the fact when one night the clouds were down to 600 feet, and I had a call from the airport to say that there were about 30 C-46s operating around Ellenikon and couldn't land, you see. So I whipped down to Ellenikon, and there was the AOC, Balkan Air Force, in his little tower in Kephissia. But down the road, somebody had put a 105mm Italian field howitzer or whatever, going boing, boing, you see. So he had to evacuate everybody very quickly, and in fact lost his headquarters. Whereas there I was down at the airport with this quite useless set of air traffic control officers, which were not mine, with 30 of these, about 30 of these B-46s orbiting the airfield, and nobody'd got them down. So I quickly got to the end of the runway and started the pre-war business of bringing them down by orders lamp, and I got 30 of them down successfully on that night. And of course at the end of the night I just took an armed guard into the air traffic control, said out, and put one of my own team of air traffic controllers in. I couldn't put up with that anymore. It didn't actually endear me to the authorities. we carried on, of course, as airborne artillery throughout the Elas Rebellion, and both by day and by night, operating over Athens. And I used to pilots used to operate over Athens at night, whopping these 105mm gun positions that were bombarding the Grand Bretagne Hotel, you see. And what you'd do, you'd sort of skim around in half moonlight over the western Athens, waiting for a gun flash. And then you'd storm down to where the gun flash was, put on your landing lights, and you could probably see the house where this gun was, and you'd just give us a quick squirt with four cannons, as an act of deterrence. You see what I mean? It was hazardous work, but by and large, it went very well.
Did it have the desired effect?
Oh, yes. The bow fighter was a quite frightening weapon. A little bit later, towards the end of the rebellion, I was escorting an armoured column progressing from Alepsis to Corinth. And some people in a little redoubt guarding the road, instead of surrendering when the armoured column came near, did a run for it. And I looked at them from my patrol position just went slowly and gently down and went brum. They disappeared. They didn't fall dead. They disappeared. So you can see it was a bit. And on another occasion, the previous day, of course, we'd had a little adventure as the armoured column had left in Levsis, where I found that one of these little redoubts that these people had put along the road was holding up the armoured column, so I went down to have a look. What was going on? And I found that somebody was firing at these people from this little redoubt, you see. So I decided I wouldn't fire, I'd just take a photograph of who it was, you see, what was going on. As I say, we were not anxious to kill. Most of these Greeks who were fighting with in the Elas, you know, thought that they were fighting the Germans. They didn't. They were fighting the British, you see. So I went and took this photograph and then had it developed from the camera gun. Guess who was firing? The local representative Time.
The local representative of
Time
magazine?
Yes.
Why?
I didn't, in the end, bother to ask him. He visited my headquarters the next morning, you see. And there he was, you see. And I was surprised to see him. But anyway, of course, he came in, you know. Hi, Commander, that sort of stuff, you see. No, I said, we've been expecting you. So I gave the wink to my adjutant, my Australian adjutant, and said to him, da-dum. So two armed guards were outside the door, you see, and fixed bayonets. No bloody nonsense. And I said to him, I've got a photograph of you. Oh, he said, how did you get that? You see? Oh, I said, have a look. There he was, firing at my bloody aeroplane. So I said to him, I have an idea. I said, in 40 minutes, an aeroplane will be leaving for Bari from the other side of Alenikon Airport, and you will be on it. He said, oh? I said, yes. And he was.
What would have been the alternative for him?
Well, I had never worked that out. But he took the hint that his mission in Greece was over.
What was his motivation then?
Well, you see, the Americans, I think it was just to get a story, but the Americans made the mistake in Greece of sending, as they did in Sicily, sending Americans of Greek extraction to Greece. And the result was that they were throughout the Elefsis, the Elas problem, they were all holed up in Elefsis, and they took no part in the defence of Athens, whatever. And why they didn't land those B-46s at their place, Elefsis, I can only assume that they were not equipped for night landings, or that the 46 chap turned up and saw the airport flashing beacon at Alenikon, and just saw the runway and just got his people circling. But that was the sort of thing you were having in the Greek thing.
So this American was of Greek extraction?
I believe so. He was short and dark. I just told him he was on his way. Yes. And he went. After about a month, things calmed down there. And I went to see...